are part of the investigation teams, dangerous conditions in the mine have kept investigators out until now. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
In the mood for a carnivorous cocktail? You've got more choices. Now that a Seattle distillery has introduced bacon-flavored vodka, a distillery in Wasilla, Alaska, has come out with a salmon-flavored vodka. Scotty McDonald, a partner in the distillery, says coming up with the right formula wasn't easy, and there were some real duds along the way, but now she says she's happy.
It's smoky. It's got definite, salmon undertones, but it's not fishy.
Ken Reither is a bartender at the Bear Tooth Grill in Anchorage. He says when customers try it, they generally like it.
Once we tried them on it, got them into the Bloody Mary, it's been taking off. It's been doing really good.
A distilled spirits trade group spokeswoman says flavored vodkas have been taking off recently. I'm Paul Brown in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Citrix, offering GoToMeeting, allowing people to hold meetings online to collaborate in real time. More at gotomeeting.com/NPR.
All this week from NPR News, coverage of the Senate confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Join me at the end of each day for a one-hour summary of that day's proceedings with analysis from NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. That's coverage of Elena Kagan's confirmation hearings all this week from NPR News.
This evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers specialty coffees, breakfast featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., and to-go sandwiches and salads for lunch. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you here. And we're also very happy to have back on the program once again, Mae Barenbaum. She is professor and head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She is a scientist who studies insects. And for a long time now, she's been here on the program to talk about insects. I always say the same thing at the beginning. Save your extermination questions, ladies and gentlemen. In fact, our buddy Phil Nixon, extension entomologist, will be here later in the week to help with that. Although, as I also have said so many times, Phil really is a love-the-bugs kind of guy and is a coexist-if-you-can kind of guy. But if you can't, we'll tell you how to get rid of him. But that's not what this program is about. The idea here when May is on is to try to enjoy and appreciate insects for the many interesting, strange ways that they go about living their lives and all the interesting forms that they take. So maybe there is something that you have seen and you'd like to know, well, what is that? If you can give us a description, the best description that you can, may be able to say what it is. And other kinds of questions are certainly welcome too. Insect questions are welcome. Here is the number, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And you also may email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. So we'll be happy to take them that way. Any old way that you want to participate, you can do that. And May will see if you can answer your question. And thanks very much for being here.
Always a pleasure. And I do have to say that we have both, Phil and I have been doing this for so long that I would venture to guess that you are the most well-informed radio talk show host on entomological issues. I'm sure you could put every other talk show host to shame with your knowledge of carpenter bee management practices.
Maybe just on that very one limited area. Yeah, I guess I could do that one. And when people call them and say, I saw this wasp. It was the biggest wasp I ever saw in my life. It was like a small plane. I could say, I got you covered on that. But no, you guys know so much. And you are so good at talking about that. I'm just here to put people on the air. That's all I'm here for. Let me see. Well, in fact, we have some callers here, and let us, I guess we'll just start out. We'll do our first caller here, and it is someone, I believe, in, I'm getting on, now this is interesting. Someone has actually sent, believe it or not, someone has actually sent us a photo. Oh, Jason Croft has sent us a photo Well, maybe we'll do that. Can you? You'll have to slide around here so you can see the picture. All right. All right. Here is the photo. It is a beetle. Looks like a large horned beetle. He's saying he does not know. He's saying that Shannon sent you this. His girlfriend sent this in and wanted to know, what is this? Is the picture good enough for you to?
Let me see if my cord can reach over here.
Okay. What do you think?
I need to get to one. To me, it looks like a female stag beetle, a lucanid.
Oh, okay.
Where was the picture taken?
Where was the picture taken? Okay.
Do we?
West Side Park. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. In West Side Park. See, we're dealing with these emerging technologies here, and I'm still a little bit. I'm an analog guy living in a digital age. In West Side Park, it does. From the photo, it does look a little bit hard to tell, but it does actually look like it has the kind that has those big horns.
The females don't, so that's why it's bit difficult to say. Unfortunately, the angle I'm looking at the screen is right where my bifocals go from. I can't quite get the angle, but there is what a female stag beetle looks like, and that's kind of what it's sort of a chestnut color, fairly large beetle, and enlarged mandibles are not dangerous if, in fact, it is a stag beetle. But I can't quite get. Can you blow it up on the screen? By
I
any
don't
chance?
Think that. Okay. We're
seeing gestures from the.
We're going to have
here.
To get him to come in here and host the damn show. Enlarge the window. Oh, okay. Maximize. Oh, there we go. You're talking. All right.
Yeah, that's a male stag beetle. No question about it. Yeah, they're quite cool. Lucanus, probably, I would guess, Elaphis. That's the most common species around here. Those enlarged mandibles pose no substantial danger to anyone unless you're another male stag beetle who has his compound eyes on a female. They're used in sort of courtship rituals. And actually, the one male will pry another one off a female. So they're not that common around here. So that's kind of a cool sighting in West Side Park.
Yeah. Around my yard, I think that I have seen these just every once in a while. And the thing is that they're so big that you're not going to miss them but if they're out in plain sight because they're so big. And I think that's pretty cool. All right. Well, there you go. Other questions are welcome. You can send photos and we'll try to make this thing work. Number 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm completely discombobulated here. Let's go to line 4. How about that? Belvedere. Hello.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
Asian bark beetle. I treated my trees last year twice. I have 4 of them.
Are we talking about the Asian longhorn beetle or the emerald ash borer?
Oh, I mean the emerald ash borer.
Okie doke.
They're all the same. They're nasty.
They are nasty, yeah.
No, I treated them last year, but I didn't treat them so far this year, and I don't see any evidence of them, but I'm concerned. Do I need to do the wait a year? Because it depends on who you talk to. Some people say, wait a year, treat them again, or do it every year. And it gets costly because when you have 5 trees, you're kind of, you're looking at $250 a pop.
Now, ordinarily, I don't take control questions, but it just happens this past weekend I went to the Michigan Entomological Society and heard a talk on emerald ash borer control. So the very latest, I guess. Where are you located, actually?
I'm up. I live in Geneva, up in St. Charles, Batavia, the northern part of the state.
Yeah, because up in Michigan was ground zero for they first found emerald ash borers in 2002, and it has since spread to 14 states and I think 2 provinces. And you're right. There is conflicting information about how often to treat, and in part it depends on what insecticide you're using. There's a fantastic new product called Embamectin. It's in the ivermectin class of insecticides that you treat once and you don't need to treat again for another year or two because it's extremely effective. But the other more standard treatments, like you probably used imidacloprid, do you know what you used?
God, I'd have to read it. I have to look at paperwork. Yeah. But the guy that actually applied the insecticide the last time did it. He was from Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
He came down here. So my guess is that, you know, whatever he used up there is the same as we're using down here. It's probably what you were talking about. But it's just that these trees have been around 16, 17 years, and they're beautiful trees. It seems like every time I turn around, either a tree or some kind of plant species every other year goes out. It's like you might as well just have rocks out there because nothing
yep.
grows without a disease.
Yep. It's, you know, a lot of it is invasive species. They're arriving at an alarming clip. I've been doing this show since, I think, 1982, and I bring my standard cheat books with, you know, that I can quickly look things up. And you know what? They're kind of useless now because most of the pests have only arrived within the last 10 years or so. So, I mean, some of them have just arrived within the last 5 years.
I'll get off and listen.
Sure.
Thank you. Yeah, anything you guys tell me would help. I know there's other issues. Like I have like five different kinds of tree species that are getting something. Now I've got my crab tree has some kind of a rust on it. And then I've got some. And what's funny is the Asian beetles, the Asian bark beetles or something. I forget what.
Asian longhorn beetle.
Yeah, the ones that were chewing up my roses. I haven't seen.
Oh,
one
Japanese
yet.
Beetle. Japanese beetle. Don't worry, they're coming.
Oh, they're here.
Yeah,
well,
they're here.
Yeah.
They're here.
Okay.
If you're up north, they may not be here yet, but they're definitely out in force down here. And they love rose bushes and they love grapevines and linden trees and about 198 other plant species. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to jump in here because we're really insect control stuff. That's not what we're doing here this morning. We can do that later this week. However, Phil Nixon, he's an extension entomologist, and his specialty is indeed control. And he's the guy we have on to answer these questions about, I have this bug, I can't live with it, what do I do to get rid of it? He's going to be on the program Thursday.
And you should ask him what he thinks about respraying. I just took that one because I just
because
heard
you
it
just,
talk.
Okay. Usually when May is here, we say, hey, you know, save that stuff because that's not
it's
her
not
specialty.
My baby, yes.
It is indeed Phil's specialty. So if you have problems with insect pests, you want to get rid of them, if you can, tune in Thursday, 10 o'clock. Phil will be here. I just, you know, the one last thing that's sort of sad, though, about the ash borer, the emerald ash borer, is that unless we can figure out some way to control this insect, within a generation, we may not have any more ash trees in this country.
And, of course, ash trees are the principal source of wood for making the best baseball bats. So that may have an influence on baseball. Hmm. I mean, odd connections. So I'm usually the fount of useless information, like the fact that emerald ash borers and many of their other buprestid tree borers like the color purple, things like that. So the traps are now
do.
Purple. Yeah, it's odd. Not all buprestids. Some like green, some like yellow. But for some reason, a number of buprestids are irresistibly drawn to the color purple. So
very well. Let us continue, and we'll talk with somebody in Belgium. Line one. Hello.
Hello. Not my question, but a little information. The wood for baseball bats is mainly the best in the eastern United States. Pennsylvania area is where the best ash grows. It's northern brown ash. It's really the best for baseball bats. The ash we have here is not quite as good. It's a little too soft. And usually the trees grow on the north side of the mountains, too. They're the very best baseball bats. But that's even more information that you want to know about baseball bats. And as far as the ash tree goes, I have literally thousands of ash trees. I have some acreage, and there's a lot of ash trees, and obviously the ash trees drop a lot of ash seeds, and there's lots of little ash seedlings, and it's just going to be sad when they all disappear because I cannot treat all of them. You know, it's just impossible to treat a woods. It's just doesn't happen.
Well, entomologists are hard at work. There are a number of different approaches. It's difficult to underestimate the urgency of this work. And just what's the propaganda here? It's one of the most preventable sorts of infestations. People schlep firewood everywhere for no really good reason.
Exactly.
And it presents really biological danger. And there, another one of the talks I heard at Michigan Entomological Society was a study at the Mackinac Bridge where a quarantine station had been established. And within 1 year, they had intercepted the transportation of over 26 different species of trees from distances as far away as Texas and Louisiana and Newfoundland. People, both directions, were carrying wood, much of which was infested, not entirely with the emerald ash borer, but with all kinds of other wood-boring beetles being taken places they don't belong. So it's incredibly preventable. Don't transport firewood.
Exactly. There's other diseases, too, like the butternut, which is a member of the walnut family. It's just about gone because of the very same reason, people transporting plants that they shouldn't transport. But for me to get on to my insect question.
Okay.
And here again, I'm going to talk about the death of insects, but not in the way that you guys object to. This time of year is not my favorite time of year, summertime, because they all just love to chew on me. There's everything insects love to chew on me. And I can understand that. I'm a big bag of protein here that probably looks pretty delectable to them. And, you know, like mosquitoes, you know, they eat on me, but then they go around and they feed other things when they have their offspring and stuff. But for the life of me, I cannot figure out what a tick feeds or a chigger. Who eats ticks and chiggers? Please tell me.
Oh, so what are the enemies of ticks and chiggers?
Exactly.
They don't have many, but for example, there are in Africa, there's a group of birds called oxpeckers, and they feed on the ectoparasites of large mammals. And the rhinoceros, the tick that feeds on the white rhinoceros is an endangered species because its host, the white rhinoceros, is endangered. And as it turns out, oxpeckers are also endangered because their food supply is at risk. One of the hardest cases to make is, for species conservation is, you know, blood-sucking ectoparasites. You know, save the white rhinoceros tick. It doesn't really resonate with most people. But, in fact, it is a complex biological world out there, and there are food webs. And there are some tick diseases and other tick enemies. But, by and large, they are most ectoparasites don't have to worry too much about predators or parasites. In fact, another timely announcement here, the entire genome of the body louse has just been sequenced. And this genome is the smallest known insect genome. And at least it has vast reductions in certain groups of genes, including genes that code for enzymes that break down toxins, because it lives in an incredibly rarefied, cushy environment. It lives only on the blood of humans and doesn't really encounter predators crawling, you know, where it's attached. And it doesn't encounter, you know, we don't manufacture poisons, except for the last 60 years or so. But it's a really interesting result to find out how reduced the body louse has about the minimum number of genes that it takes to make an insect. So it's an interesting scientific project here.
So what you're saying then, most bloodsuckers don't seem to have people who suck their blood.
There are some exceptions. The old big fleas have little fleas upon their backs to bite them, and little fleas have lesser fleas, and so ad infinitum, is true to some extent. But most ectoparasites who are fairly faithful to their hosts have only one real enemy, and that's the host itself. So there are all kinds of adaptations that ectoparasites have for not annoying their host. Sometimes those don't work too well, as you pointed out, because they do cause itching. If you have chiggers, by the time you itch, the chiggers are long gone.
So. That was what I was going to ask you. Now, they don't burrow into your skin.
Nope.
They just bite you, and that's it.
They basically liquefy your skin and suck it up.
Oh,
it's fairly disgusting. Yeah. Yes, right?
Oh. Now, how big are they? They must be extremely small. You never see them.
Right, right. They are quite small. They're the immature stage of harvest mites that are free-living, not parasitic, as adults. They are, how do you measure that? They're very almost microscopic. I mean, you can see them with the naked eye if you know what to look for, but they're quite small.
What do they look like?
Let's see. Well, they are typical ticks, tick-like. They're mites or ticks are they're related to spiders, but unlike spiders that have the two major body regions, the so-called cephalothorax, which is a head-chest arrangement, and abdomen, ticks and chiggers and mites have that same arrangement, but there's no clear definition between the head-thorax part and the abdomen, so they just kind of look vaguely oval or semicircular, not semicircular, sort of circular. So you can't really see a waist on them, yeah.
Just a little dot with legs then.
And then you can often see the mouth parts sort of projecting outward. Baby mites and ticks have only six legs, but the next stage up have eight, and everything past that stage has eight.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, I'm so sympathetic. I was last night, I was out lighting up barbecue to make dinner and didn't really notice until I got back inside that I had been bitten three times by mosquitoes. And once again, I found myself asking that question, what earthly good are these things? Because kind of like this caller, I'm lucky in my backyard. I don't have ticks and chiggers, but I certainly encounter mosquitoes and they seem to like me real well.
Well, mosquitoes are not permanent ectoparasites. They have a free living stage and when they're immature, they live in sort of decaying plant vegetation and bodies of water, and they are important components of food chains. And the adults as well are free flying, so dragonflies eat them, purple martins eat them. So there's a great deal more mosquito appreciation in amongst the wildlife than there is amongst the humans.
Mm-hmm. All right, I guess I'll take that. May Barenbaum is here. She's our guest. She is the head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She's a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And occasionally he's here on the program, and we talk about that. Again, please, no extermination questions. Save them for Phil Nixon. He'll be here Thursday if you can wait. Otherwise, we're here to contemplate the interesting and appealing, if you can find them, features of the insect. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And on to a couple of Urbana people here. Next caller on line two in Urbana right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm wondering if Ms. Barenbaum can tell us about water striders. We installed a small pond in our backyard a few years ago, and lo and behold, water striders showed up. Did we bring them in on plants? Did they fly in at some stage? What is their life cycle?
Sure. I really like water striders, so thanks for asking. There are all kinds of variations. They're true bugs that we entomologists call only insects with sucking mouth parts bugs. Well, only certain insects with sucking mouth parts, certain kinds of sucking mouth parts. So they belong to the true bugs. And in the family Geridae, these are all the water striders. And they're a bunch of different species. And a lot of them are used to living in temporary ponds, so bodies of water that are not sort of like Lake Michigan, there year-round. So they are very good at flying to bodies of water when they appear. So it's not surprising that they ended up colonizing your new body of water there. Because some of them actually do, well, they'll fly one generation and then have reduced wings on subsequent generations. Hmm. So they can't, when they live in temporary bodies of water, they will overwinter, for example, in nearby woods. But they are called, of course, water striders because their way of locomotion, they actually ride the surface tension. It's very cool. They sort of distribute their weight across the surface of the water, and they have a very special arrangement of tarsi on their legs because normally there's a claw, and if you have a claw, you'd break the water tension. It's like putting your, the water molecules have to cling to each other more than they cling to your body parts. So their claws actually offset so it doesn't break the water tension, and they skim along the surface. And they're predators, and they're very good at not breaking the water tension so that they can stay above the water. And what they eat mostly are insects that aren't quite so well equipped for riding the water tension and end up getting sucked below the surface film, and then they're helpless prey. They're all predators. They have an interesting way of communicating. They can actually communicate by vibrating the water surface. They can detect signals that are transmitted across the water surface. So that's how they find each other, and they can form these flotillas, these sort of aggregations, and it's how they find their mates and the like. Other interesting, utterly unimportant facts about water striders. One of my favorites is that in England, they're called Jesus bugs because they walk on the water.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
All right. Thank you. Very good. Let's call, talk to somebody else. Here, another caller. Also Urbana, line three. Hello.
Hi. I've got a question about Queen Anne's lace.
I saw
the most wonderful caterpillar on mine. I always leave a few in my garden, and the caterpillar was huge, about the size of my little finger, and I looked it up, so it would be a monarch or a...
Black swallowtail.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I'm wondering how important the Queen Anne's lace is to the survival of this caterpillar, and in what stage? I mean, can I cut it down in the fall, or should I? Is there going to be some egg or something that needs protection over the winter?
That is an incredibly wonderful thing to ask. This is a really interesting story, at least. I find it interesting. The black swallowtail, Papilio plexnes, a beautiful black butterfly with yellow spots, and the females have a gorgeous blue patch on their hind wings. It's actually a native U.S. butterfly. It's native to North America, and it feeds only on plants in the Queen Anne's lace family, the carrot family. Queen Anne's lace other name is wild carrot, and that's in fact what it is. It's an escaped version of the domestic carrot. Don't try to eat the root. It's all woody and white and not very tasty because, you know, we've had centuries of artificial selection to make the nice long orange one. But the interesting thing about this insect, this is an American insect that today is found almost exclusively in the wild in alien weeds. So it loves Queen Anne's lace, which is European. It loves wild parsnip, which is European. And it loves poison hemlock, which is another roadside weed, which is European. Its native hosts are actually fairly inconspicuous, low-profile native plants in the carrot family, like water hemlock, golden alexanders, some other native umbellifers that nobody sees anymore. So this is one insect that has truly benefited from European colonization of North America, bringing our nasty weeds with us, because now this species is found from Newfoundland all the way down sort of through South America. And almost everywhere you can find it in the wild, it's on these European weeds. So,
well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, you can cut down your Queen Anne's lace and there'll be plenty more Queen Anne's lace and wild parsnip and other noxious weeds to maintain this butterfly. And in addition, if you plant fennel or dill or parsley, those are all in the carrot family. And this caterpillar will only eat plants in this family. Very discriminating. You can tell, even when I have undergraduates who can't tell what plants are in this family, this butterfly, this caterpillar never gets them wrong. And it overwinters in the pupal stage. So it doesn't feed during the pupal stage. So again, another reason you can cut them down. Then another interesting thing about this butterfly, it has multiple generations in central Illinois. And as a pupa, you know, that's that dormant stage where all its tissues reconfigure from the caterpillar organs to adult organs, and then it comes out as a beautiful butterfly. The chrysalis, sometimes it's called. Uh-huh. In the summer generations, the chrysalis, the pupa, is green because it's nestled in among green vegetation. But somehow, and it probably has to do with background matching, sensing the background, the overwintering pupa, the one that goes through this diapause or hibernation, is always brown.
Oh.
So at different times of year.
With the old foliage.
Yep. So at later in the season, Right now, if you were to rear this caterpillar through, it would it could be a brown pupa. Odds are good if it's on a green plant, it'll be a green pupa. But in the fall, the only stage that diapause has this hibernation is the brown stage. Because you don't want to be green in the dead of winter in central Illinois.
No.
Kind of like a big sign that says, eat me. So.
Well, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Right. Oh, and one more thing.
Yes.
I just love the fact that you're teaching a course in beekeeping.
Thank you. We are so happy to be doing this. It's the first time we've taught beekeeping in over 30 years.
And I wish I could have taken it.
Well, we're hoping to offer it every summer, so
okay.
Look for us next year. And one other thing about your black swallowtail caterpillar.
Mm-hmm.
Have you touched it?
Oh, this was last year. I don't have one right at the moment.
Well, if you touch it, you don't be surprised if behind its head out pops a little Y-shaped gland that smells like rancid butter. That's one of its cool tricks.
Oh, good. I'll go look for one.
I've always wanted to go on David Letterman with stupid insect tricks, you know. I thought this one would, I think he'd really be impressed by
it. I think there's a great possibility for that. Thank you very much. So now, just real quick, before we go to another caller, how many people did you have sign up for your beekeeping?
I think the total tally was 17. It was a little hard getting the word out. But the college allowed us to teach it. They like a minimum of 20. Everyone I've talked to is having a terrific time. The kids... it's all kinds of people. Start with the basics. They even build their own bee boxes. So it's everything you need to know to be a beekeeper.
And what's your minimal investment if you were going to go into keeping bees? I mean, what's it cost?
There's such a range. It's hard to say because some people start by finding a retiring beekeeper and buy those supplies. From new, next time I'm on, I will give you a number.
Okay. I'm just curious
but
one decided
the price of honey is going
that.
Up, so you could recoup your expenses fairly quickly.
Okay.
And apropos of that, the University of Illinois Press is coming out with a book. It's called Honey, I'm Homemade, dessert recipes that are sort of based on from university entomologists and their friends and associates, and it's a benefit for our new pollinatarium, our out science center for pollinators and plants. So if you're into honey, if you become a beekeeper, you can even buy a cookbook full of honey recipes.
And that's going to be out in August?
It looks like September now.
Okay. So. Very good. We have other callers. We have several, and we will go next to Urbana and line one. Hello?
Good morning.
Yeah.
I just returned from doing a breeding bird census down in Douglas and Piatt County, and while I was doing it, on the bill of my cap landed a rather large insect. And like out of the corner of my eye, I could see it was pretty big, so I took my cap off, and it was the biggest mosquito I have ever seen in my life. and I was out in a heavy agricultural area. I don't have any idea what it was doing out there, but I actually brought the mosquito back with me, and I'm looking at it right now. And it's gigantic. I would say that it's a half an inch from the end of the little proboscis to the end of the abdomen. It is huge. So what can you tell me about numbers of species of mosquitoes in Illinois, and do you know what this gigantic one might be?
Well, most gigantic mosquitoes aren't mosquitoes at all. They're called crane flies, and immature
no
stages...
crane flies. But this is nothing like a crane fly.
So the biggest, if it is in fact a real mosquito, probably it's a Toxorhynchites species. The Toxorhynchites are the rogues among mosquitoes. They actually are not parasites. They don't feed on blood. In their immature stages, they feed on other mosquito larvae. They're cannibals.
Oh, I see.
And meat diet, I guess, this carnivorous diet allows them to grow fairly large. And in fact, they need that size in order to subdue and consume other mosquitoes. So you say about half an inch. That my guess is it's probably a Toxorhynchites. As far as I know, those are the biggest mosquitoes in central Illinois.
Okay, good. Well, just say the name of the genus one more time, and then I'll hang up.
Okay. Toxo, T-O-X-O, Rhynchites, R-H-Y-N. I can't do this. C-H-I-T-E-S. Yes, I think that's it.
Okay, that sounds about right. Okay,
toxorhynchitis.
I'll look it up. Thank you.
And if it's not, call back.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks for the call. You were going to say, though, that I think that probably there are things there that insects that are good-sized that look kind of like mosquitoes. When people see them, they think that they are mosquitoes, but they're not.
Well, most people who aren't quite as insect-savvy as the last caller that call me and say, I'm the world's biggest mosquito here, it's usually a crane fly, and they can get to be more like an inch long. And to the untrained eye, they look exactly like mosquitoes. The way you tell a mosquito from just about any other large, long-legged fly, there's very esoteric traits, including scales. The mosquitoes have very hard to see scales on their wings, and a couple of other really esoteric traits that are hard to see.
And crane flies will not harm you?
Crane flies are completely innocuous.
All right.
To everybody, basically.
Okay. Let's see. Mae Birnbaum is our guest this morning, by the way. In case you didn't know, she is head of the Department of Entomology at U of I. She is a scientist who specializes in studying insects and occasionally is here on the program. We talk about them, not the extermination thing. We'll do that later in the week, Thursday. Phil Nixon will be here. This is the Love the Bug show. That's the Get Rid of the Bug show. We try to keep those two things separate. Love the Bugs questions, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign.
Hi, is that me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoy your program. There was a pollinator walk on Saturday, and Alex Wilde was there, and he was pointing out a little predatory fly that sits on the top of a leaf and gobbles up aphids and the like. But the exercise was how to photograph some, and so some of the students, including Christian John, have already put that up on YouTube. And it's just makes me wonder if there could be, I know it's costly to do visual things, but if there could be a gardener equivalent of master entomologist, and could it be a visual program where you could point out some of these things that are so difficult to bring up visually, digitally. So if you could say a little bit more about what we might do in the future. You're doing things with beekeeping, and there's just so much wonder there that we could do with other things too. But I think the general population is starting to get much more aware of their native vegetation, their prairies, and some of these interactions that you're talking about.
Mm. I think that's a fantastic idea. Is that David Monk by any chance? Hi there. He's one of the most incredibly well-informed, knowledgeable prairie savants. I don't know how to, you're the prairie whisperer, I guess. So thank you so much for helping with pollinator, National Pollinator Awareness Week, and showing everybody what there is to see in a prairie. I know I'm a little off topic here, but when Europeans first settled this area, they really didn't appreciate what they had in terms of plant and animal diversity here in the prairie. And I think we're really late to understand what an incredibly unique and wonderful community it is, a living community. In terms of a master insect naturalist or master entomologist, maybe it's 30 years of being an apologist for insects. I'm not sure we've reached that moment in our cultural history where we have enough interest to recruit citizens into an insect appreciation army, as it were. I wish that were the case. And our department, our program here, will keep plugging away. I think I've mentioned before there's an entomologist in Mexico who did a worldwide survey of attitudes toward insects, and the Champaign-Urbana community came up worldwide at number one as the most insect-knowledgeable community in all of his surveys. So I'm waiting for him to publish that. I think that would be something we could put on the signs as you get off the interstate, you know? Welcome to Champaign-Urbana, insect-savvy community.
Okay.
All right.
What about the little insect? Tell me a little bit more about the fly that is a predator that's so tiny you hardly see it if you're walking along, but if you brush on the leaf, it will fly.
Do you remember which what the genus are, the family?
No, I don't.
In fact,
we had two groups, one photography group that got all wound up in just taking photographs of this creature, and others that they were more interested in general things.
Well, I have to check. There are a number of predaceous flies. It always surprises people. People think that flies are sort of garbage hounds, but there's a whole group of flies that both in adult and immature stages prey on other insects that are slower. Most things are slower than flies. Chamomyid flies are predators. There's acylid robber flies are predators. There's all kinds of predaceous flies that range in size from tiny to fairly large, and they rely mostly on speed and in some cases for the legless predaceous maggots just on stealth because you can't really run things down to the ground if you have no legs. So.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I'm sure the reason that there are so many insect-savvy people here in Champaign-Urbana is, of course, it has long been the home of the Insect Fear Film Festival. I'm sure that that's really what it is.
I expect that's a major factor, yeah.
The internationally famous Insect Fear Film Festival. Okay, let's go on and talk with somebody else. Urbana, this time, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Last winter, we had put a whole bunch of dead leaves around a magnolia tree in our front yard. And then this spring, my wife was going and cleaning them out, and then we found around 20 really big white grubs inside, probably about an inch long. And it looked like next to one of these grubs, there was a great big beetle, maybe just a tiny bit smaller than the white grub, you know, way too big for a Japanese beetle. And we don't know what they are, and if they're good or bad for the tree, and if it's a bad idea to put leaves around a tree like that.
Can you describe the beetle? The grub is going to look like pretty much any grub. So, I mean, it was sort of a C-shaped grub?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And can you describe the beetle?
The beetle was black. I think it had some kind of triangular maybe marking on the top. I can't really remember it all that well.
Did it have sort of a waist-like looking affair or no?
Waist-like looking affair?
Yeah. Did it look like it had, you know, you clearly could see head, thorax, and abdomen?
No, I think it was like just a big round thing.
Because it's unclear if it was feeding actually on the leaves, the dead leaves or the roots, but they're generally a C-shaped grub is in the family Scarabaeidae. That's the same family as the Japanese beetle, but it's a very large family, and there are some much larger beetles than the Japanese beetle. The Japanese beetle itself actually lives on grass roots. Mm. But there are some scarab beetles that live in association with roots of other plants. The other C-shaped grubs are hard to tell apart.
Okay.
So without knowing specifically, like, for example, passalid beetles live in rotting, usually oak logs. I don't know if you had any rotting oak around. Those are completely innocuous and actually have a sophisticated social system. But without knowing more details of the adult beetle, it's hard to say whether they're good guys or bad guys.
Oh, doggone it. It was weird to see only one adult, you know, and then like around 20 grubs.
Well, that probably was an early riser, I guess.
Okay, so for now, maybe just sort of keep an eye on these guys. And...
Yeah, and if you get more adults, then that's the stage that's easier to identify. Experts can take a grub, and the way you separate these grubs is they have little tiny hairs on various parts of their body, and you have to count the hairs, and it's really difficult. But once they become adults, it's fairly easy. And then where, you know, who they are will determine whether or not you should get rid of them.
Okay.
And so ask Phil on Thursday.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
That's great. Thanks so much.
We have several callers. We'll try to get them in. We have another photo here. It's been submitted by a listener. You're going to have to come out. Now, this is a much bigger picture. Someone who's listening in northwestern Pennsylvania says, can you identify this right there?
Oh. Yes, I can, actually.
She is so good.
That, thankfully, that is the four-eyed milkweed beetle, Tetropes tetrophthalmus, which the name literally means four-eyed. And it's on milkweed. I can't speak to the caller because it's not a call. This is the, it's a Cerambycid, the so-called longhorn beetle. You can see the long antennae. Mm-hmm. And it feeds as a larva or grub on the roots of milkweed. And then as an adult, it comes out and feeds on the leaves of milkweed. It's the only plant it eats is milkweed. And it's orange and black, quite conspicuously colored because it stores in its bodies the poisons that milkweed plants make. So they're called cardiac glycosides. And if you swallow cardiac glycosides, you'll throw up. So don't eat the beetle.
Okay. So that's one of those things that the color
is
a warning.
Right.
And we've talked about this before. Then there are some other insects who saw
shams,
that and say, aha, that's very good. So I'll be that color too. Even though they don't make those toxins, they think, well, if I'm that color and any bird has ever eaten me and thrown up, they say, well, I'm going to stay away from anything that color.
Right. So that's it's called aposematic or warning coloration. But these guys are the real thing. They sequester the toxins. They're not poisonous to handle or anything.
All right.
But they're very cool. They're called four-eyed because their very long antennae actually anchor to the head, and the eye wraps around the base of the antenna. So it looks like it has eyes on top and eyes on the bottom.
Oh, all right. Well, very good. I thank the listener. And let's go to Matt Toon next, line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I wonder if you could comment about mayflies and caddis that might be living in Illinois.
What mayflies and caddisflies might be living in? Well, we're not really rich with mayflies and caddisflies because both mayflies and caddisflies tend to rely on clean, pure, flowing water, which we don't have a superabundance of here, at least in central Illinois. But anywhere there, the caddisflies, of course, are they in their immature stages. There are all kinds of lifestyles. They're most famous for making little cases out of bits and pieces of the environment. Some make little stone cases, and some make little stone cases that they cement into this sort of a spiral shape of a snail shell. Some stitch together little bits of leaves or twigs. And the mayflies are perhaps best known as being the favored food for all kinds of sport fish that anglers like. So mayflies are the most famous or the most popular models for anglers who tie their own flies because every stage of the mayfly is popular for, say, trout fishing. And we don't have a lot. We do have some, but they're environmental scientists, I guess, have a scale for assessing water quality. It's called EPT, and that's Ephemeroptera, Plecoptera, Trichoptera. What does that mean? It's the mayfly, stonefly, caddisfly index. So the more EPTs you have, the nicer the water quality. And in general, at least in central Illinois, our water quality is not high, and our EPT quotient isn't high either.
All right, thank you.
Sure. Very good. To Piatt County is the next person here. Line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'd like to go back to bees. I just came in when you were discussing it, and I went to the Pollinatorium or
Pollinatarium? Uh-huh.
Yes. And they had a catalog there that was just wonderful, and the woman was just so generous. And she gave it to me, and of course I can't find it, but the set up for a small bee, if you didn't want like a major population, was $115 for everything but the bees.
Great.
And so my question was, I didn't decide to go ahead and do that because I live, I'm trying to establish a prairie, and everything comes on late. So would there be enough, you know, if you started a small, like a couple of hives, would there be enough in the early spring for them?
Bees are amazingly resourceful, and there's actually nectar available in sources that we don't really typically think of as available. There's some trees produce nectar, for example. And there's even honeydew. Bees will collect honeydew. Honeydew is the sugary excrement of aphids that feed on fluids in plants. And that it's so sugar-rich, they actually have to dump the sugar in order to get enough protein. But honeybees do collect honeydew in the absence of nectar. And in fact, in Europe, honeydew honey, they make honey out of this honeydew, is highly regarded and quite expensive. Although when you think about it, it's aphid excrement that has been regurgitated multiple times by a honeybee. But, you know, no accounting for taste.
That's right, exactly. But then my other question is, what about the winter? I mean, I have this horrible feeling. I guess I'm so unknowledgeable. I'd have to read up a lot on this. But
yeah.
Do they take care of themselves? Or
Well, they need some help in the winter. But they do have remarkable ability to maintain the hive temperature at a constant level. They store the honey principally to keep warm and active during the winter. And, in fact, honeybees won't defecate in the hive, so sometimes in a warm winter day, they'll all fly out, relieve themselves, and come back in. So, but there are plenty of people. We have beekeeping societies all over the state. Lots of people will help you, and you can always call our department, too, for help.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Again, very well. And we'll go to another caller here, and that would be someone in Champaign, and line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have an interesting question. Now, you may or may not know the answer to this or may have some thoughts on it, but I hear a lot of people say that if you have allergies, to eat locally produced honey. And the thing about that is that all of the plants that are causing people to sneeze and suffer from allergies are wind pollinated.
Right.
They're not insect pollinated.
Correct.
So I don't understand why so many people, even seemingly knowledgeable people, say to eat locally produced honey, because that those bees are not visiting wind-pollinated flowers. And so the honey really has nothing to do with the species that are causing pollen that's causing people to suffer. So I was wondering, is there any other mechanism that could make that true?
Well, I always wondered about that, too. Giving them the I mean, because it seems questionable to me as well, because as the caller was saying, the allergenic pollens are the ones that are wind pollinated. Bees do not collect those in general unless they're really desperate. So they shouldn't be overrepresented in honeys. So the only most charitable spin I can take on this, I don't know of any controlled studies, and there's all, anecdotal evidence is really suspect under all circumstances, but it's conceivable that there are certain proteins that are present in all pollens that might may represent the major allergens that induce an immune reaction. So if there are highly conserved proteins across all pollens, whether they're wind or insect pollinated, then maybe that's the mechanism. That's the most generous spin I can put on it. I don't know of any scientific studies that indicate that local honey will help reduce your allergies.
All right. Well, we're just about the point we're going to have to stop. And we've gotten through all the callers, and we really appreciate all the questions. It's always a lot of fun to do this. And I'll say one more time that then if indeed you do have an insect pest issue, later in the week we'll be dealing with that. Phil Nixon, our buddy from Extension, will be here. And so if there's something that you truly cannot deal with, you cannot live with, Phil will tell you how to get rid of it. And in the meantime, if you'd like to read more insects, you can go to the bookstore, the library, and look for some of May's books like Bugs in the System. The most recent is The Earwig's Tale. There's also Buzzwords, A Scientist Muses on Sex, Bugs, Rock and Roll, the ever-popular 99 Gnats, Knits, and Nibblers. And then coming up maybe in September, this book that you mentioned that's the honey cookbook. So if you're even if you don't keep your own bees, you don't have to do that to get a good honey. And so you can get some good recipes there to know what to do with them. Hey, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
May Barenbaum, she's professor and head of the Department of Entomology here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
And now we'll take a break for an update on the markets and news. Stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets, where at mid-session, there is a lot of red on the screen, although prices have come back a little bit from the numbers we have seen earlier. Traders clearly letting some air out of the futures balloon ahead of tomorrow's quarterly grain stocks and acreage reports. USDA expected to show big corn stocks as well as increased acreages, bearish influences on future prices. Let's look at particulars. In Kansas City, July wheat at 473.5, down 5.5. December, $5 down 6. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 444.25, down 5.25. December, 487, down 6.75. July corn, 328.25, down 5.5. September, 337, down 5.25. December, 346.75, down 6. July soybeans, 955, unchanged. August, 940.5, unchanged. November, 919, and they are up 1/2. July soybean meal at 293.90, up 160. July soybean oil at 36.14.